I became politically active because of my belief in certain principles. And once those principles got breached in the Republican Party, it was no longer possible for me to stay.
I'm Jeff Cavaservis from the Niskanen Center.
And I'm Kodiak Hill-Davis with the Niskanen Center.
Welcome to the Vital Center podcast, where we try to sort through the problems of the mighty, muddled, moderate majority of Americans, drawing upon history, biography, and current events. We're honored to have Linda Chavez with us today. Hello, Linda.
Hi, Jeff. How are you?
I'm okay. Linda is a senior fellow at the Niskanen Center. She's one of the participants in the Bulwark's Beg to Differ podcast with Mona Charon, and she's one of the country's premier political analysts and public policy advocates. We're really glad you could join us today, Linda.
I am too.
How have you been faring during the pandemic?
Well, life did not change all that much for me. I have worked at home since 1987, and that was wonderful, particularly when I was raising teenage boys. But it really just meant that I go out even less than I used to, and my wardrobe does not have to be nearly as up-to-date as it did when I had in-person meetings. But I still comb my hair and put on makeup every morning. So, you know, something hasn't changed.
I'm trying to keep that discipline as well myself.
Well, I assume not makeup, but...
No, none of that. Linda, as I was getting ready for this podcast, I found myself thinking that it's difficult to sum up either your career or your political output and outlook. But let me attempt an incomplete sketch of your political career. Correct me if I get anything grossly wrong. You entered politics from the left, working for the Democratic National Committee here in Washington. And then he became a staffer on the House Judiciary Committee just before Watergate made that a very interesting place to be. You became a lobbyist for the National Education Association, which is the largest teachers union, and then did the same at the American Federation of Teachers, which is the second largest. You briefly served at HEW during the Carter administration, then went back to AFT, essentially as the editor of its American Educator Quarterly magazine and assistant to Al Shanker, who was the union president. I should add that I was a regular reader of Shanker's weekly New York Times column, which I guess you had something to do with.
I actually had nothing to do with it. Al Shanker wrote that column himself.
Okay, well, terrific. But I did come across some of the other articles that you wrote for the magazine, as well as other people who would soon be called neoconservatives, people like Bill Bennett and Jean Kirkpatrick and so forth. Am I right in thinking that you cast your first vote for a Republican president for Ronald Reagan in 1980?
That's exactly right. I was still a registered Democrat. I know when I went into the booth to cast my first vote, and in those days there was actually a lever that you could pull that could do a straight Democratic ticket. I then didn't use that lever in 1980. I had to do it individually, and I voted for Ronald Reagan at the top of the ticket, and I was very concerned that God was going to strike me dead, or that my father looking down from heaven was going to be very disappointed.
And what was it that attracted you to Reagan after having spent most of your formative years on the left?
Well, I was on the left, but it was a sort of interesting niche of the left. I always call it the right wing of the left. I was involved as a young woman with my husband, more involved than I was, with a group called the Young People Socialist League.
The Yipsils.
The Yipsils, yeah. And the Yipsils were the right wing of the left. They supported the war in Vietnam. They were against things like racial quotas. They really were, in many respects, what today we would call neoconservatives. They were very hardline anti-communists. And I had grown up Catholic in the 1950s and 1960s, attended Catholic school, was imbued with anti-communism all of my growing up period, both at home from my father, but also in school. And I... you know, was even though I briefly served in the Carter administration during the 70s, I noticed that the world was going in the wrong direction, that the Soviet Union was taking over larger and larger spheres of influence in Africa, in Latin America, in Asia. And I thought Jimmy Carter was totally ineffectual and was not really equipped to deal with the Soviet Union. He discovered in 1980, after the invasion by the Soviet Union into Afghanistan, suddenly he discovered they were a major threat. And his answer was to pull out of the 1980 Olympics, which to me didn't seem exactly the, you know, most effective means of dealing with Soviet communism. So I really found Ronald Reagan's foreign policy and his defense policy appealing. I hadn't yet signed on to his economic policies, but that was the reason I voted for Ronald Reagan.
And then just 3 years later, in 1983, you actually joined the Reagan administration, and you held a number of appointed positions in that administration and the George H.W. Bush administration. These included staff director of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, White House director of public liaison, and chair of the National Commission on Migrant Education. You became a political candidate, a well-known conservative commentator and columnist and author. In 2001, George W. Bush nominated you for Secretary of Labor, making you the first Hispanic woman nominated to a cabinet position, although you withdrew from consideration. And you were also the founder and chairwoman of the Center for Equal Opportunity, a conservative think tank focused on affirmative action, immigration, and bilingual education. But not even a month ago, you tweeted that you were leaving the Republican Party, and you laid out your reasons why in a January 17th article in Real Clear Politics entitled "Leaving the GOP, Why I'm Now Politically Homeless." So we're talking to you at something of a historic turning point.
Well, that's right, you know, and a lot of Never Trumpers, particularly more moderate Republicans, have made an easy transition from being Republican to leaving the Republican Party and becoming Democrats. I've already made that switch. I went the other way. I went Democrat to Republican. And as a friend of mine said, you already ran screaming from that room once. You're not going to go back back into it. And that's sort of the way I feel. I'm not a Democrat. I just have too many fundamental disagreements on policy issues. I like Democrats. I think I'm culturally more comfortable with Democrats. I feel more at home at their conventions. You know, some of my best friends are Democrats, as we would say. But I really am philosophically more conservative. I have a little bit of libertarian leanings in some direction, but not on everything, certainly not on national defense and foreign policy issues. And so I am homeless.
Without necessarily going point by point through the article, could you tell us something about the process that led you to no longer feel that the Republican Party could be reformed from within?
Well, you know, for 5 years in the Trump era, I kept waiting for a critical mass of critics within the Republican Party to emerge and to take on the xenophobia, the racism, the sheer incompetence of Donald Trump and his administration. And it never happened. I mean, there were a few voices here and there, you know, Mitt Romney at some point, you know, a handful of others, Ben Sasse, Adam Kinzinger, you know, others, individuals who would raise their voices, but it never became a movement within the Republican Party. And so I waited and waited and waited. And then the real break was over the election and Donald Trump and the party leadership's unwillingness to accept the results of a free and fair election. That was it. And when Josh Hawley decided that he was going to join this insane conspiracy that suggested there was a way for Congress to basically overturn the results of the election, that was it. I'd had enough. I said, this party can't be reformed from within. I'm leaving. And even if it, you know, can be reformed from within, I just don't see my playing a role in that.
Linda, that's so interesting to hear you walk through what the breaking point ultimately was for you, especially after, as you mentioned, five years of kind of toiling in the wilderness of being Never Trump. It's interesting to me that of all the erosions of normative precedent and our democratic institutions, that really it sounds to me like what put you over the edge was the undermining of the faith and credibility of our election process, which is absolutely critical to our healthy and functioning democracy.
Right. I did not believe in the wake of the election that the Republican Party stood anymore for Republican small r or Democratic small d ideals. The idea of representative government chosen by the people, in which all sides agree that they will give up power when their side loses, that seemed to be being violated in the most outrageous way. It was run out of the White House, but there were so many people complicit in the Congress, in the states, that it just seemed to me that the Republican Party had become a threat to democracy.
And that's something which is so much deeper and more significant than a policy difference.
That's right. That's right.
What kinds of reactions have you received to your renunciation of the GOP?
Well, not unexpectedly. Some people said good riddance. You were never a conservative anyway. Of course, I got the sort of usual racist attacks that I often get when writing on these subjects, basically, you know, telling me to go back where I came from, that sort of thing. It was really basically hostility from people either who do not know me or who thought they knew me but apparently did not understand that when it comes to principle, I've never been a party person in any party. That's not who I am. I became politically active because of my belief in certain principles. And once those principles got breached in the Republican Party, it was no longer possible for me to stay.
Have any Democrats implored you to join their ranks?
Yes, a lot of reaching out of Democrats saying, oh, you know, come on, you're welcome here. And I think part of the problem is that, you know, because I have a kind of moderate tone, I'm not a red meat type person. I don't engage in overheated rhetoric, even when I'm debating. I, you know, try to keep things at a intellectual level. Doesn't mean I don't go for the jugular. I do, but never in a kind of personal attack, never basically, you know, you're on my side or you're an enemy. And so I think because of that, a lot of people think of me as a moderate. But when I go through and list what I believe in on a lot of issues, it's pretty apparent I'm really pretty conservative. And so I don't think the Democrats would be all that comfortable with me trying to work within the Democratic Party to try to pull it back towards the center. I think that was something that I was actively involved in the 1960s, early 1970s. I was friends with the person who founded the Coalition for a Democratic Majority, Penn Kemble. I was very involved with some of the people involved in that effort, people like Ben Wattenberg of AEI and others. But they don't exist anymore. And many of them became neoconservatives. And even if they didn't change their party registration, they found themselves much more at home, certainly in the party of Ronald Reagan and the two Bushes, if certainly not in the party of Trump.
So, Linda, this is actually an interesting point, and I think I'd like to expand on it a little bit more, and I'm sure Jeff has some thoughts here too. But what I've really heard you articulate is that they're kind of a spectrum of political beliefs, and they don't fall neatly into these binary categories, Republican and Democrat, and that without the nuance and the ability to kind of explore those variances, a discussion around why you're a Republican or why you're a Democrat becomes a lot more challenging. But it also becomes a lot more challenging to create, you know, a big tent party, so to speak, because everything comes down to these kind of arbitrary purity tests, so to speak. Have you found that to be the case, that you, because you have a more nuanced approach to your political affiliation, that you don't fit tidily into any category?
Well, I felt perfectly comfortable in the Republican Party prior to Trump, even when I didn't agree down the line on each and every issue. And with respect to the Democratic Party, there are just too many policies on which I disagreed where I think I'd feel comfortably there. But the reason, you know, that I left was not about policy. It wasn't really fundamentally even about personality. It was about this belief in democracy and my real fear that the party had become a personality cult of someone who very admiringly pointed to people like Kim Jong-un and Vladimir Putin as people he respected. And the anti-democratic tendencies are the ones that worried me. You know, parties are not social clubs for me. You know, it's not like I would hang around the RNC or hang around the Republican, you know, club or go to every Lincoln dinner. And that was never the point of my being involved in the Republican Party. It was to fight for things I believed in. And so, you know, being homeless, yeah, it's not great, but it's not all that uncomfortable either.
Linda, what are the issues on which you are the most conservative these days, in your opinion?
Well, I believe very much in an aggressive American foreign policy, and aggressive, I don't mean aggressive in terms of taking over other countries. I mean putting a foreign policy very much at the top of the chain of what is important and what, you know, a president needs to be involved in. I believe that the United States is part of the world and that we've been a leader in the world and that we've been a force for good. I believe in a strong national defense. I believe that the one thing that we must do is to keep ourselves with a large enough defense budget that we never have to fear that we will be the object of another country's attempts to undo our way of life. On some of the issues, social issues, I believe very much in equal opportunity. I am a firm believer and was active even as a young, you know, teenager in the civil rights movement in the 1960s, and been very interested in civil rights issues ever since then, and very active in them. But I'm very opposed to the idea that you can end discrimination against one group of individuals by deciding that you're going to give preferences to those who've been discriminated in the past in order to undo that discrimination. I don't think that's the way to do it. I think you have to have colorblind equal opportunity available. I think that there are going to be disparities and inequities in any society. But I think jumping to the conclusion that race is always the single factor that's responsible for those inequities is wrong. I do not believe that we are a country that is deeply racist. And I think there is not the kind of systemic racism that Democrats talk about all the time. I don't believe that. I don't see it. In fact, I think what I see is a country that's come a very long way in undoing the wrongs of the past. Doesn't mean we are a perfect society yet, but that we're not going to get to be that perfect society by deciding, for example, to discriminate against Asian students when they want to be admitted to a prestigious university in order to make room for more Black or Latino students. So those are areas that would make it uncomfortable probably for me to be in the Democratic Party.
And are there particular issues that you've changed your mind on in recent years? You know, it's often said that one of the reasons that Trump gained the Republican nomination in 2016 was that the party's base had been moving in the direction of the working class, and the Republican Party didn't have much of a populist component to its political outlook.
Well, I haven't changed my mind about populism. I've always been very worried about populism. I don't think populism any place in the world has turned out to be a force for good. So I've changed there. I have changed my mind about healthcare. I was opposed to Obamacare when it was initiated. I thought it was not a great plan. I really disliked the fact that it was passed by, you know, straight party line vote. And I thought that was a really bad idea for such a sweeping change. I think you have to have buy-in from both sides when you're going to have major sweeping change. And I wasn't sure that it was absolutely necessary. I have changed my mind about that. And I think as I wrote in my piece for Real Clear Politics, there's nothing like a pandemic to have you change your views about universal health care. You know, it turns out that it's for the good of all of us when each of us has access to, you know, a certain level of healthcare, that we can't protect ourselves from something like a pandemic when there are huge swaths of people who don't have access to healthcare.
You know, you said you don't really identify with the political label of moderate, but, you know, moderation is a kind of temperament, as you have said. And it seems to me that one of the things that unites people in whatever moderate might mean as a political species would be, you know, again, a lot of the things that come up in your writings, a commitment to civil rights and civil liberties, a belief in objectivity and evidence, a refusal to tolerate violence, a willingness to change one's mind, and a willingness to make deals with the other side, which implies an ability to compromise, and I guess an interest in governing as well. Does that sound more or less
that right sounds to you? Exactly right. Yeah. And I absolutely plead guilty to having a moderate temperament. I've actually been rather proud of having a moderate temperament. I don't swing the pendulum. You know, I look at some characters who come to prominence on the right, who used to be on the left, people like David Horowitz, for example, you know, who was perfectly comfortable at one time with the Black Panthers, you know, who was involved in, you know, the SDS, the Students for a Democratic Society, and other very left-wing groups. And then suddenly he switched right and, you know, he sort of passed that center-right line and kept on going. And, you know, now he's all in for Trump and all in with conspiracy theories about stolen elections and everything else. I think that that kind of mercurial temperament is not healthy in politics. It's not healthy for individuals. It's not certainly not healthy for politics itself. And one of the great things about American politics, in my mind, is that it has always been a pendulum that shifted, but shifted around a center point. It might shift a little bit left and it might shift a little bit right, but it never goes to either extremes, at least not until the Trump era. And that, I think, has been part of the story of our success as a nation.
I would agree, Linda. And I think it's interesting that as the rise of the kind of Trump era and Trumpism, we saw more and more registered voters switching from the Republican Party into the kind of independent registration. I think it's something like 44%, which is a pretty remarkable uptick from where it had been prior to Trump. And I wonder, what do you think the Republican Party could do to start winning back the confidence of some of those voters, voters like yourself?
Well, it has to start behaving more like the party that it once was with respect to disavowing extremism. When you have members of Congress who are QAnon supporters, who have called for the execution of Democratic officials, who, you know, insist on bringing their guns into the House chamber, you're not going to find a whole lot of people who've left the Republican Party and become independent who are going to be, you know, rushing back to be embraced in that party with those involved. So I think the party itself has got to begin to really disavow the extremism that we've seen over the last 5 years. And unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be happening. I was very happy when former majority leader, now minority leader, McConnell was willing to denounce the Trump insurrection and to, you know, to lay the blame on the president's doorstep. Kevin McCarthy seemed for a very brief time willing to do that as well. And then he pulled back and, you know, very soon after, 3 weeks or so after the insurrection on January 6th, he was down in Mar-a-Lago kissing Trump's ring. So I think it's going to be very difficult until you can, you know, disavow some of the extremists and particularly have the leadership stand up to that kind of extremism. You're certainly not going to bring people like me back.
Linda, you wrote in your Real Clear Politics op-ed that I remain a conservative, but I am no longer Republican, nor do I want anything to do with the conservative institutions and intellectuals that have enabled Donald Trump's nativist-driven populism. And you linked to the statement of unity by scholars and writers for Trump. It occurs to me that you would once have considered many of the signers of that document to have been friends and intellectual comrades in arms. So how does it feel to have them on the other side at what feels like a politically and even morally defining moment?
Well, you know, for a time during the Trump era, I did in fact reach out, particularly to folks at the Claremont Institute, to try to change some minds. Some of the people who are on that list, I won't name them, but I reached out as late as after the election to say, what is going on here? Do you not see that what you're doing is aiding and abetting an attempt to move away from, you know, the peaceful transfer of power? This is undemocratic. And basically, you know, most of the people just sort of blew me off. So there were early signs. And it's interesting, some of the earliest signs of this growing populism and anti-democratic faction began during the early days of Trump's candidacy and his term in office around the issue of immigration. This was an issue that really divided people. And I have found that most of the people who became Never Trumpers were very uncomfortable with the nativist tone of the pro-Trump faction. And that, you know, became a real dividing line. And I know I wrote a few times for the Claremont Review of Books and for American Mind. I think I wrote in one of their very initial newsletters on the subject of birthright citizenship. I had battles with John Eastland on that subject that went at great length. John Eastland is somebody that I hired as a young man, I think barely out of law school, when I worked at the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. And he's become the real voice of the anti-birthright citizen movement. So I don't know that I can understand or that I've come up with a clear understanding of why it is that immigration was the breaking point and the issue that's divided so many people, but it does seem very fundamental to who ended up on which side of the divide in terms of pro-Trump and anti-Trump.
Linda, I've expressed my belief that the Republican Party really can ill afford to lose you right now because, how do I put this? It seems to me your background and experiences would make you an ideal guide to the likeliest potential positive path forward for the Republican Party. And by that, I mean, you know, the 2020 election showed that despite Trump, significant number of minorities in this country are, in fact, attracted to the conservative ideals you've always articulated, and also repelled by some of the ideas coming from the left for similar reasons to those that repelled you in the 60s and 70s. And there's a positive sense in which the Republican Party could emerge as a one-nation party focused on the needs of the multiracial, multi-ethnic working class, or continue down the rabbit hole of, I guess I'd call it Trumpian nihilism and QAnon insanity. And what I found really interesting about rereading your political autobiography, An Unlikely Conservative, how much that has to say about our present political moment.
Well, thank you. And yes, I do think that, you know, there was the famous or infamous autopsy report that was issued, I think it was after, what was it, 2012 election? I think so.
Yes, right.
That said, you know, the Republican Party had to be more, you know, had to do better outreach, and particularly to racial and ethnic minorities. It didn't do a very good job there. But I think that even that autopsy misunderstood how to reach out. And it wasn't to reach out and say, oh, gee, we have a Hispanic Republican club for you to join. It was rather to appeal to them on issues. And one of the interesting and in some ways surprising and disheartening things about the 2020 election is that Donald Trump did reasonably well among Hispanic voters. He did especially well in the border areas of Texas. And I think part of the reason for that was that the emphasis was on promoting his pro-business, pro-small business efforts, getting rid of regulations and helping really push the economy into overdrive. And a lot of the young and not so young Mexican Americans in that part of the country were small business owners, or even if they weren't small business owners, you know, at the present, hope to be one someday. And so there was still an appeal from Trump on that basis. It wasn't an ethnic appeal. It wasn't reaching out. And in fact, I think many of them just simply disregarded his xenophobic, nativist, often racist comments and just decided not to pay attention to them. But it's, you know, it is interesting to me that the party often, when it tries to reach out to Blacks and Hispanics in particular, they do it in a very clumsy way, and they make it all about race and ethnicity. They do it, you know, trying to beat the Democrats at their own game, and they can never beat the Democrats at that game. So I think you're right. I would hope that there were more people who understood that community. I wrote a whole book about Hispanics in the United States in 1991 called Out of the Barrio, and in which I previewed that Hispanics were moving more and more toward the Republican Party. And this was a natural progression. They followed in the footsteps of other groups like Italian Americans who went that path. But unfortunately, the people who tried to do this seemed to do it clumsily at best.
Something that really struck me in your memoir is that your experience as a Hispanic emphasized the diversity of the Hispanic story in America. And yet so much of that debate about identity on the left really narrows and flattens the depth and breadth of that experience.
That's exactly right. I mean, the whole term Hispanic was a creation of government, really. The Hispanic ethnicity box that you check on the census form was created to try to figure out how to lump a whole bunch of people who have not a whole lot in common in terms of their national origin stories together. And it was done quite consciously with a push within particularly the Mexican-American communities to try to vie with the African-American community, the Black community, to get a place at the table. And it was clear that if you split up Hispanics into their, you know, various subgroups, that it wouldn't be as effective to, you know, to go to ask for more help, more programs, et cetera, as if you all banded together and therefore had a bigger group. And that's why Hispanics, for example, today are the single largest of the various ethnic minority groups. They surpass Blacks some time back. So yeah, my background is very different. I'm from New Mexico. When people say, go back where you came from, my family's lived in New Mexico since 1601. they came there as part of the expedition by Juan de Oñate that conquered New Mexico for the crown of Spain, and they've been there ever since. It's very different than somebody who's a recent immigrant from wherever, from Mexico, from Argentina, from Honduras, from Cuba, from any number of places. It's a very diverse community.
And speaking Spanish is not necessarily what defines a Hispanic either.
No, in fact, during the Nixon administration, there was something called the Cabinet Committee for Opportunities for Spanish-Speaking People. And one of the reasons that that was quickly abandoned was that it turned out that a lot of people like myself didn't grow up speaking Spanish. Depending on how long your family had come here and, you know, what the circumstances were, there had been transition to English in New Mexico, which has the largest Hispanic population of any state in terms of the percentage of the population. When I was growing up, it was actually a majority. It's now very close again to being a majority. It's about 44%. But, you know, most Hispanics who are from New Mexico don't speak Spanish. And if they do speak Spanish, the Spanish of their grandparents or great-grandparents, it's a kind of strange 17th century version that, you know, people from Mexico won't understand.
Fascinating. And you said that you didn't experience discrimination in New Mexico when you were growing up there, but when you moved to Colorado, you did.
Yes, it was very interesting. As I say, in New Mexico, where we were a majority of the population, I knew bankers that, you know, had names like Chavez or Sanchez or Martinez, and also very poor people with those names. When I got to Colorado, Mexican Americans in Colorado were primarily the southern part of the state. They were people who, like my ancestors, had come early in the 17th century. But those who lived farther north were often people whose ancestors had come as immigrants after the Mexican Revolution in 1910. And so there were big differences, and there was a lot of discrimination in Colorado when I was growing up. I mean, there were, you know, people, a neighbor of mine, young kid who I was friends with, who couldn't take me into his house because his mother didn't allow Mexicans. You know, there it was not uncommon to be called names and made fun of and, you know, other things growing up in Colorado. It was interesting that even within the Hispanic community, when I was in school, I was viewed differently because I was from New Mexico. So I didn't quite look the same as many of them did. My skin was lighter. I had a different cultural experience. I ate different foods. So it was, you know, it wasn't all one big happy family.
Something else that impressed me about rereading your book is that you wrote it about 20 years ago. And in the time since, the Republican Party has really moved much more in the direction of being a working class party. And you were one of the relatively few commentators, I guess, on either the right or the left, who came from a working class background. And your early experiences were often difficult, even at times Dickensian, shocking, harrowing.
Yes, that's true. Again, people look at me now and see, you know, what I've done and assume I came from a very middle class, maybe even upper middle class background. And simply not true. My dad had a ninth grade education. He was out of work a lot of the times. He had a problem with alcohol. And because he did not have a whole lot of education, he didn't have a whole lot of opportunity. My mother, by the way, is not Hispanic. My mother is English and Irish. Which also made a difference in the way in which I was viewed. My father spent time in prison. My grandfather spent 11 and a half years in Fort Leavenworth prison for bootlegging during Prohibition. So, you know, I don't have a kind of normal normal working class background. I come from a pretty rough background. And, you know, when people call me an elitist today, I always say, I'm happy to be part of the elite. I worked very hard to get here.
What is it that you wish more political figures understood about the working class?
Well, I think I wish they understood better the struggles of what it means. And they were, you know, sort of more sensitive to the fact that opportunities, you know, I had lots of opportunities because, you know, I don't mean to sound conceited here, but I was smart. And so I was able to do well in school. And, you know, I worked hard and was able to, you know, get out of the circumstances from which I, you know, in which I'd grown up. But not everybody has that opportunity. And so I think sort of being more sensitive, not assuming because people talk differently or, you know, don't have the same cultural tastes that you look down on them. I think the whole idea of looking down on people is, you know, very, very harmful.
Linda, you know, something interesting again about trying to place you politically is that you are between certain kinds of extremes. You yourself experienced discrimination as a woman, so you're obviously no fan of sexism, but neither do you really identify with much of what goes under the name of feminism. You've always been very forthright against discrimination, but you've also, to some extent, made your name by going up against affirmative action and the civil rights establishment and a lot of the most aggressively forms of identity politics. And you're also very pro-immigration and pro people from Hispanic backgrounds, and yet your book is subtitled at the bottom, How I Became the Most Hated Hispanic in America.
And I was dubbed that, by the way. Hispanic Magazine gave me that title, so that wasn't my self-designation.
So I guess a problem is you've spent your career in up till now in the Republican Party, much of it. And I can understand how the Republican Party would oppose some of the progressive attitudes towards these issues. And yet the Republican Party often seems to have nothing really positive to offer in place of what it opposes. And you mentioned healthcare. And, you know, I certainly lived through the debacle of the Republican Party calling to repeal Obamacare and replace it with nothing.
Right. Absolutely. That's exactly right. Yeah, that was just so cynical. It was kind of on beyond belief. But, you know, you mentioned my opposition to affirmative action. Let me correct you there. I'm not opposed to the original idea of affirmative action. In fact, I'm very much in favor of it. I was involved in programs that behaved according to the original principles of affirmative action, namely that there be more outreach. And that when you couldn't find enough qualified candidates, either to, you know, enter a education program or to get a job, that you provide them opportunities to be able to get the skills that would enable them to compete on an equal footing.
And you were one of the first people to teach in the affirmative action program at Colorado University.
That's exactly right. And in fact, I went to the English department. I went to the chairman of the English department. It happened to be that I was a very good student, a top student in the English department, and I had, even though I was still a senior, I had been admitted to graduate school. And so I went and said, look, you've got a bunch of Hispanic students coming in. I've been part of recruiting these kids. They're not going to be able to make it at the University of Colorado if they're not given some help. And so would you let me create a program to basically teach grammar, writing, and other skills to this group of students coming in. They were given an extra year instead of a four-year program. It was a five-year program. And the first year, you would spend giving them the skills to be able to compete in the university setting. And I was part of helping create that.
So you're talking about something which is not quite the blunt instrument that affirmative action often is, but also is just not ignoring people.
That's right.
Who are in need.
Look, there are disparities. There are inequities. I mean, if you're born in certain zip codes, your life chances are not the same as being born in other zip codes. It's just a fact of life. But that doesn't mean that you decide that you're going to set quotas based on people's skin color and ignoring, for example, which zip code they were born into. I mean, one of the things that, you know, when my sons graduated from high school, my oldest son in particular, he started being recruited for affirmative action programs in various schools, despite the fact that at the time we lived in one of the wealthiest zip codes in America. And he was, you know, being recruited because he was part Hispanic. He, you know, turned all those down. He did not participate in those programs. But it was, you know, ridiculous to have those programs reaching out to someone like my son. Those were meant for, actually, they would have been more appropriate for someone like myself who grew up poor. As it turned out, I didn't need it, but there are a lot of kids who might have needed it. And, you know, looking at social and economic disadvantage to me is a much better way than simply looking at race or ethnicity.
So to some extent, what Kodiak and I spend a lot of our time talking about is a somewhat imaginary Republican Party that does care about these issues in the way that you're describing. So can you imagine then what a Republican Party that really wanted to offer positive policies to benefit Hispanics, working class people, people down at the bottom of the socioeconomic income class, what kind of policies would those look like?
Well, I mean, the first and most important thing is to make education more available and make the content of education better than it is now. Interestingly, that was part of, you know, the effort during the Reagan years. Bill Bennett, who was then Secretary of Education, was very involved in the education reform movement, as was later Diane Ravitch, who became an assistant secretary for education under George Herbert Walker Bush. And the whole emphasis was on improving all of the sort of basic skills, getting kids the knowledge that would prepare them to be able to compete on an equal footing. Unfortunately, that really dissipated. And today, the kind of education that kids are getting, elementary and secondary schools, is very deficient. When I look back on my own education, I often say one of the reasons I am where I am today, not one of, I think it was a primary reason, was my Catholic school education. The nuns were taskmasters. They were hard. It didn't always make me happy. But I learned things in school about math, and my introduction to literature and reading was much more sophisticated than you see today. I read great books at a young age. Part of that was my father, but part of it was the school. And there was just a much greater emphasis on learning things like history, American history, European history. We had a good foundation. And I think that is probably first and foremost what many young children who are from poor socioeconomic backgrounds lack today.
Well, and today it also seems that even if there are some pathways to advanced education, the financial burden, if you're coming from an economically distressed area or without more economic stability, even the opportunities to advance your education beyond, you know, primary school are pretty onerous. It's pretty hard to get there. And to deal with the student loan debt on the other side, I think you're absolutely right that those economic barriers to entry are pretty significant, even when coupled with better educational opportunities.
Absolutely. I mean, in today's environment, if I were born into exactly the same circumstances as I was in 1947, but born, you know, in perhaps 1997 or 2007, it would be very different today, the access to education. When I went to college, my first semester, I paid for the tuition myself. I worked. later on, I was able to get work study grants and get some scholarship help. But mostly I had to pay for it myself. But that was possible to do at a time when my quarterly or semester tuition was $250. So, you know, it's very different. And even with inflation, I've never done the figure to see what in inflation adjusted dollars that would be today, but I would suspect it's far below what you would see at a state school. And that is part of the problem. And I must say, you know, when you talk about some of the Democrats and some of their plans, the idea of being able to provide at least a AA degree, two-year community college degree, to students from lower middle and lower economic strata, I believe would be very important to enhancing people's ability to be able to make it on their own later in life. I do think that high school degrees now mean what a, you know, two-year community college degree would have meant a generation ago. And so I think we do need to expand access, universal access, particularly to those who can't afford it.
I suppose what I have trouble with is not the Democratic plan to offer open access. It's more the reality of knowing that even now in places where community college is affordable, a lot of people still don't get through. And I suppose in sort of thinking about, you know, where I would situate myself on this issue between extreme small government conservatism versus Democrat idea of providing a program for everyone, I would look at something like the Accelerated Study and Associate Programs at CUNY, which seems to me is built on the recognition that people who are, generally speaking, in poor and somewhat difficult situations in life need help getting through, but it's not just economic help. But it can be help for things like books, for subways. They also need a lot of counseling and someone one-on-one to sort of encourage them and give them help when they're needed, and especially to intervene when it looks like they're dropping out. So I guess I see sort of a sort of more personalized form of government as the kind of thing that could be more at play in education than it is now.
And it doesn't have to be government, by the way. You can have other institutions intervene as well, and voluntary institutions that can provide that kind of mentorship and help. And by the way, it's not just in education. You know, I see it in the small business community, young Black and Hispanic people who want to start their own business, but, you know, they don't begin to know how to set up their books or to do some of the more difficult tasks. And what they need is mentors. What they need is to be able to couple with somebody who's done this successfully and is able to help them through that process. Give them the skills to be able to succeed. What they don't need is a set-aside program that says you're going to get an advantage. You can put it a bit higher than everybody else, and you're going to get it simply on the basis of your ethnicity or your race. And oh, by the way, we're going to support you in this program for a certain number of years. And then when you're out of the program, you're on your own. Well, what you've just taught them is they could be the high bid instead of the low bid. And in American business, that's not a very good business plan. You don't, capitalism, you know, is built on the idea that you offer the better service for less. And so, again, teaching those skills, but it doesn't have to be always government. I think this is probably where I'm more conservative. I think we've lost that sense of civic responsibility to try to work to help each other, not always being paid for it or having, you know, a pot of money set aside to make it happen, but based on our own sense of ourselves as part of a community.
Linda, I think that's such an interesting point. Over the holidays, I watched for the very first time with my family, It's a Wonderful Life. And at the end of that classic movie, the community really rallies around a community member to help him because he's helped all of his fellow community members throughout this film. And it really struck me that in all of the conversations we're having in the last 5 years about politics and political party and political identity and kind of where we see our nation, there's really been a loss of community, a sense that we're all in it together and that we all succeed together or we fail together. It's so interesting to me that you came to a point on that, not just for educational opportunity or economic opportunity, but that outside of government, that we need an enhanced sense of community.
Well, and, you know, talking about the rise of QAnon and some of these other crazy groups, what they provide to the people who, you know, join them is community. And I think there is almost an innate hungering for community within human beings, that we are social beings and that we look for a place where we can feel safe and where we can find people who are like us, who believe the same way we do. And so the kind of communities that have built up in recent years have not always been healthy communities, and quite the contrary, some of them have been very destructive communities. And it's sort of like, you know, nature abhors a vacuum. And if we don't provide good, positive communities that can attract people, particularly working class people, they're going to fall into bad communities. It's very similar to what happens in, you know, Hispanic neighborhoods with gangs. You know, if you don't have a good, positive community that can bring in these kids, often children of immigrant parents who work double jobs and who never seem to have time for them, if you're not providing, you know, other places for them to find a sense of community, they can end up in a very bad community, the gang community. So I think this kind of civic renewal is something that's very important and that we're missing in our culture. And it's something that if we lose it altogether, we're going to be in big trouble.
How would we move toward that kind of civic renewal?
Well, I don't know that we have enough time. And I'm not an organizer, so I'm not, you know, necessarily the person who could give you the steps to how to go about organizing that kind of community. But certainly churches are a place to start. The Republican Party, as you talked about, parties can be a place to start where they set up structures that give people a sense of community, but one that's not just purely political, but one that is more based on providing services and help to the entire community. All of these, I think, are places. But, you know, there are also nonprofit groups that can help in this. There are, you know, a variety of sources. It's kind of the little platoons that Edmund Burke talked about.
So something that troubled me about your autobiography was that you were describing the changes of the 1960s, particularly at the university level. And it seemed that so many of these changes were destructive of this kind of community. You know, I was struck by a statement you made about why you voted for Ronald Reagan. And you said, on most issues, I was still the Catholic schoolgirl, respectful of authority, more comfortable with a fixed moral code, and with the reverence for tradition and decorum. And that seemed very much the kind of view that radicals in the 60s were striking against, and are kind of repeating the same errors now.
I think that's right. And that's absolutely true. I mean, one of the reviewers of my book noted that it was silly to think of me as a newly minted conservative, that I really was clear from the book that I'd always been conservative. In that sense, I was. But there was a comfortable place for conservatives, even within the Democratic and liberal structure of our parties at that time. And that became less so as a result of the huge cultural shifts that took place in the 60s. Interestingly, again, even in the Republican Party, you know, family breakdown among lower middle class and lower class whites is today at the level that it was, you know, during the era in which Daniel Patrick Moynihan talked about the breakdown of the Black family. This is a phenomenon that has spread, and the breakdown in traditions and morality, I think are it's important to understand that it's not just a constitution and laws that undergird our society. There is a certain kind of moral framework that's handed down from generation to generation that we're missing today, and it's really broken down.
And again, you know, when you're talking about the kind of feminism that was on the rise in the 1960s, this is a feminism that actually was quite antagonistic toward marriage and childbirth.
And family, yeah, right.
And
marriage in particular. But the whole sort of liberal ethos today is that you don't need to be married to have a child, that there's nothing better about growing up in a two-parent household than there is in growing up with a single mom. I mean, you know, children don't get to choose whether they're born into a family with two parents. that, you know, that's a choice that's made by the parents for them. So it isn't that we should ever look down or blame or cast aspersions in some way on those family structures. But it is, you know, important to recognize that human society, as it's been built, has been built not just on the nuclear family, but also on the extended family. Again, that was very important in my growing up. Having, I lived, you know, for much of my earliest years, you know, with my grandparents near at hand, sometimes in their house, sometimes in a little house on their property. The extended family was extremely important to me. And I think we're going to start seeing more of that now. You know, older folks are been sort of cast out and sent to nursing homes in recent years. And during the pandemic, we saw that that didn't work very well. So I think you're going to start seeing, again, more intergenerational households among even the middle class than you have in the very recent past.
Well, certainly Jeff and I have both spent large portions of 2020 and I think even maybe portions of 2021 visiting family and coexisting as you just described in a multi-generational household. And I can tell you it was a great comfort to me, especially during the tumultuousness of 2020, to be close to family and to be living in more of a community-based environment instead of just on my own.
Yep, I think that's true. I mean, again, growing up in Albuquerque, my friends were my cousins. You know, that's very traditional, by the way, in a lot of Mediterranean, isn't just Hispanic or Spanish families. It's certainly true among Italians, it's true among the Irish as well, that, you know, that your first circle of friends are people whom you're related to. But, you know, certainly during the pandemic, my granddaughter has an apartment here in my house, and it's been wonderful to have her. That multi-generational unit has been terrific, particularly during these times when, you know, it's good to have somebody young around who can go to the drugstore and go to the store with less fear of, you know, getting coronavirus. And it's been very, very helpful to my husband and to me.
So, Linda, it seems to me that you're articulating a kind of positive vision of the kind I was talking about earlier. Do you think that this eventually will find its way into either of the parties, or do you place any kind of hope in a third party?
Well, third parties have never done very well in the United States. I mean, having three parties, I don't think for a long term is viable. On the other hand, it doesn't mean that what was the Republican Party might transition, that you might have a third party arise that would draw off the saner, more moderate in terms of temperament Republicans who are still within Donald Trump's party and leave Donald Trump's party as kind of a rump. That would be the way I would imagine you might see it developing over the next few years. Some of it will depend. I mean, it's really a little early to tell what's going to happen to Trump and his influence. He has been largely silenced, and how long that will last, I don't know. But he doesn't have his normal outlets of Twitter and Facebook and going to, you know, huge rallies. He did raise a whole lot of money, so he might at some point decide to start those rallies up again. I'm not sure. But, you know, I think over time that his draw will be less and less. And I frankly do not see Don Jr. or Ivanka or anybody else in his family stepping in to take his place. For whatever negative things I could say about Donald Trump, one thing was clear. He was really a showman in a way that I don't think any of his other family members have shown a particular talent for.
Do you feel optimistic about the future of women in the Republican Party? You know, I'm sure Kodiak can speak to this issue better than I can, but some people would say that the 2020 elections proved that the Republican Party has turned a corner on getting women into politics, and others would argue that in many ways it's the same old story.
Well, it certainly did get more women in and more elected, but not all of them were people I would want to be associated with. Congresswoman Green coming to mind, first and foremost. I don't know that women or anybody else is much help by having a QAnon supporter in their ranks. Again, I've sort of never really liked the way of looking at it in terms of, you know, do we have more women or do we have more Hispanics or do we have more Blacks? Well, well, I'd like to see more of everybody in. I'd like to see them there based more on what it is that they're espousing and what they have to offer and what they're going to do than simply on their, you know, racial or sexual characteristics.
Linda, that's such a good point. And as I mentioned before we started recording, my other day job is as co-founder and political director of Republican Women for Progress, which helps equip and empower Republican women to seek elected office at the state, even local and federal level. And I think your assessment is absolutely spot on in that we don't want to check a box with our female candidates. We want them to run because their experiences are unique and their perspective is really good and that they feel that they have something to offer their community. And perhaps most important, that they want to be in the business of governing, not necessarily just getting in the spotlight by espousing crazy ideas or even deeply problematic ideas, like in the instance of Congresswoman Green. One of the things we found most challenging about getting more Republican women elected is that there wasn't really a party infrastructure that spoke specifically to them as candidates. Now, maybe spoke to them as voters, but to run as a Republican woman, there are different considerations. And we found that when we did more outreach, we found all these great women coming out of the woodwork, these great skill sets, and really ready to run. They just were needing a different kind of approach and a different kind of infrastructure.
And there are still barriers that are difficult to overcome. One is raising money. Women have a harder time raising money as candidates, to make a generalization, than men do. I raised what at the time was a lot of money when I ran for the U.S. Senate from Maryland in 1986. But, you know, it was not necessarily my skill that got me to be able to raise that money. At the time, my husband had been in the political arena and worked in Republican circles, and he was very helpful to me in raising money for my campaign. So raising money is one thing. Also, depending on age, family responsibilities. I had young children when I ran, and that was hard. My oldest son was in college, and so he was a volunteer in my campaign and spent a lot of time with me during the campaign. My younger two boys were still in elementary school, and I would take one or the other of them, usually not both of them, because they would be fighting if together if I did, on the campaign trail with me. But that's a hurdle. And the way in which mothers are perceived on the trail is also different. When I was running, what I found is that Republican voters thought I ought to stay home and be taking care of my kids. And, you know, a lot of Democratic voters thought I should be a feminist and, you know, shouldn't necessarily be having kids in the first place if I wanted to be in politics. So it was sort of a harsh environment. I think it's probably less so today, but it's still a challenge. I mean, it's a challenge to balance any kind of work and family life. I've managed to do it, but I've been very fortunate in being able to do it, and not everyone is able to. And that, again, that comes back to this, you know, multi-generational families. It helps to have, you know, grandma and grandpa around.
Absolutely.
What would you say to a young woman who shares a lot of your beliefs, Linda, but is looking at you heading into the political wilderness and maybe is discouraged by that fact?
I would say don't be discouraged by it. You know, it's hard to run as an independent. I wouldn't advise you to do that. So, you know, you sort of have to cast your lot with where you feel most comfortable in either the Democratic or the Republican camp. And I wouldn't be discouraged by it. You know, I've had a lot of years being involved in the fight to earn my spurs as a discouraged former Republican. If you're young and just getting started, give it a try.
That's probably the closest we get to optimism on a show like this. So let's end there. Linda Chavez, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a real pleasure and an honor to talk to you.
Thank you very much, Kodiak and Jeff.
Thank you, Linda.
And thank you again to everyone listening for joining the Vital Center podcast. All the best.